I had a wise Greek professor in college, Gerald Hawthorne, and he was a member of a Brethren church where it was much more common for people to just have public sharing even in the morning service. And I wasn't there, but I heard about a time when somebody in the congregation asked the question, "What is time?" And the guy that was like in charge of it said, "Well, Dr. Hawthorne, I wonder if you could answer that question for us." And he stood up and thought about it for a minute and said, "Time is what keeps everything from happening at once." And then he sat down, which is a pretty good answer on the spur of the moment.
Yeah.
But time is part of God's creation. It is not, being in time is not the result of the fall, but actually part of the way that God created us. And you see right from the beginning a marking out of time in the way that the world is made, a separation of days and seasons. There's an orderliness that time brings that, in effect, does keep everything from happening at once. There's a progression to things, a structure to things that's reflective of the way that God has made us, and in some way reflective of his character, at least reflective of the work that he did in making the world and then resting from making the world. All time is God's time in another sense. You'll be familiar with also the passage in Ecclesiastes, isn't it, where everything has its time. There's a time for this and a time for that. There's the sowing time, there's the harvest time. And there's a sense that that, too, is under God's providential care, that he's given certain times for certain things, and this is part of his providential governance of the world. All time is God's time. Our time for this kingdom work, the kingdom work of this life, is finite. In fact, it's very limited. Typically, when the Bible talks about time or how much time we have to do the things that God has called us to do, there's an emphasis on the brevity of life. We're encouraged in the Scriptures to have a kind of sober assessment. We shouldn't go through life thinking, "Oh, well, I'll have time for that later," or "I have all kinds of time." That's not the sort of thrust of biblical thinking about time and how much time you have. No, today is the day of salvation. Now is the time when you really need to put your trust in Jesus Christ. Maybe you'll live 70 years, maybe 80. Psalm 90 says that was the perspective of Moses. But even those years are going to be pretty difficult, and then they're going to come to an end, and let me talk to you a little bit more about death and what that's like. That tends to be the biblical perspective, and also the perspective of the second coming of Christ, which is always considered to be something that's going to happen soon. So there's a constant state of readiness, preparedness, but also a sense that, this world isn't just going to go on and on and on like it was from the beginning. I mean, it's the pagan that says that. That's the perspective that they have. But that we're looking forward to an end time, both of our own lifetime and also of the world generally. All time is God's time. Our time for the kingdom work of this life is finite. And here is an arena for God's redemptive work. You may know the verse, redeeming the time for the days are evil. That's a very hopeful perspective. It's sober about the kind of world we live in and the kind of times we're living in, and certainly it's characteristic of our times. But there is there's an urgency in that verse, redeem the time for the days are evil, but there's also a sort of hopefulness about it, that there's some redemptive thing that God can do with the time that we do have. Can have a redemptive purpose in our own lives. There are things that we can do that will honor God and advance his kingdom with the time that we have. So there's a redemptive aspect to our use of time, or there can be. And each of the things that I've said so far should be impressing upon us the importance of good stewardship of time. I mean, if time belongs to God, then like all the other things that belong to God, it should be used well for His glory. If our time is limited, then like a lot of things that are limited, you want to choose wisely what you do with what you have. And if this is an arena for God's redemptive work, then I don't want to be thoughtless about my use of time. I want to be deliberate, prayerful, discerning, exercise good stewardship. All of these principles encourage us in the direction of godly stewardship. I've already hinted at this in what I said about Genesis 1, but we experience both the effects in the arena of time. We are confronted both with our fallenness and with our finitude. I think it's helpful in thinking about time to realize that there are two dimensions of it. There's just the fact of our finitude, that we're not infinite. We can't be in all places at the same time. You know, we don't have, you know, God's abilities in that regard. And that is true simply because of the fact that we are created beings. That's not a result of the fall. I mean, Adam had 6 days to work and 1 day for rest. He had a structure and order to his existence. And this was a good thing, and is a good thing, because it reminds us that we're creatures and we're not the creator. So I think we're more prone to have a sort of negative view of the limitations that we have with time, when actually the Bible also gives us a very positive perspective on that. I can't be in two places at once. Here are some things that I'm going to need to trust the Lord for because of that. In fact, I did a Window on the World a couple of years ago on, which I think I entitled Embracing Finitude. I should embrace that. I should embrace the limitations that I have as a creature, because they're reminding me that I do have a God and that I am not that God, and I need to have the proper perspective about that. Now, having said that, we also deal with the effects of fallenness, of our fallenness and the fallenness of others, because time can be wasted through sloth, and that's a sin, and typically when we waste time through sloth, that has other consequences, because that was time that could have been used for some other purpose, and maybe it could have been used for prayer, and now we're more vulnerable to temptation, or maybe it could have been used for service, and that would have been, you know, a blessing to somebody else who might have been a missed opportunity. There's also, I would say it is possible to steal time, to overstep the boundaries that are appropriate in a relationship, demand more of someone's time than is really appropriate or that they have a calling to give, or there are other sinful things that end up costing a lot of time. You're not actually stealing the time directly, but you know, maybe somebody vandalizes your property, or they take your wallet and you have to do all the things that you have to do to get your credit cards sorted out. Well, that's a lot of time that could be spent for other things. And so part of the pressure of time is not just our finitude, but it's also living in a fallen world. Both the decisions we make about our time and the decisions that other people make that end up affecting our time. It should not be surprising, then, that this is an area of struggle, at times frustration. It's just part of, being a depraved person in a depraved world. That there's our experience of time bears the mark of sin. And both of those dimensions, the finitude and the fallenness, need to be taken into account. In terms of the use of time, there is in the Bible clearly a work principle and a rest principle. It's given in creation 6 days for work and a day for rest, and that's reinforced in lots of other ways. Doing our work in an excellent way with all our strength. There are, you know, a number of scriptures that encourage us to that. Also recognizing our need for rest, which is also God's gift to us, recognizing our finitude, and also, a special blessing to have a day of rest in a fallen world, all the more so be a blessing in itself even in an unfallen world, that it goes beyond that in a fallen world. And you have both of these principles that are important in terms of the stewardship of our time, the stewardship of our work time, the stewardship of our rest time, and we face temptations in both of those areas. They're both important areas for stewardship, and they relate to one another, how we view our calling and our work may impact our ability to find the rest that God, you know, has called us to do. Not using our rest wisely may make us less well equipped to do our work well. So there's often an interplay, but both of those principles are part of a total perspective on the stewardship of time. I would also say that I can't give you so much a verse for this exactly, although maybe somebody could come up with one, but I think it's appropriate in our stewardship of time to recognize both the value of certain things that are task-oriented and things that are people-oriented. And that's a complex issue for a couple of reasons. I mean, one is, I think particularly if we know the parable of the Good Samaritan, we feel a certain pull when we have certain tasks that we know we need to get done, and we have a calling to get done, but then there may be some people-oriented need that's emergent, and now how do I think about that? What is the proper claim? And there's a certain kind of person that will always set aside the task to be with the people, and there's a certain kind of person that's more drawn to saying, no, I have my tasks I need to get done. I've got my list here, and I know I've got a calling to do this, and I can't be distracted from that to help with these needs. And that's often, there's a sort of dimension of task and people that's part of that pull. There's no, as far as I'm aware, there's no sort of simple calculus for figuring out, you know, which calling has the priority. But I do think it helps to think of our more task-oriented duties in terms of how they relate to other people. So, you know, you have a calling as a student to take full advantage of the studies that God has given you. You make a financial investment in that. Other people make a significant investment in all kinds of ways, particularly if you're married, but not just in that case. And you are making an investment in those tasks, not for any usually immediate ministry that you're doing, but with a vision to the people that you will serve, having, you know, followed that course of study and pursued that with excellence. And I think if you just look at it in terms of tasks or people, you maybe don't see the full picture the way that you do if you relate the tasks to the people that they serve. So, you know, and you can apply that in all kinds of different ways, and it has a lot of applications in life. You know, tasks that are helpful to Lisa around the house. They're important in their own right to do them, but they're more so because of the relational dimension of those tasks. Similarly, and I'll, this is as good a time to talk about it as any, particularly if you're in a regular teaching or preaching ministry, the time that you have for the study of God's Word and the preparation to teach or to preach in reading, study, prayer, meditation, thinking, writing, you know, all of those kinds of things is supremely important, particularly if you bear, you know, as I do, kind of a primary preaching or teaching role in the church. There's a sense in which, you know, I kind of view that in some sense, it is sort of my time, because it's my time to get the things done that I need to get done this week. But actually, in a more important perspective, that's time that belongs to the whole congregation. And there are people that, you know, there are, you know, mothers that are concerned about their children that need the fruit of what I'll teach. And there are, you know, people who don't know Christ that need the benefit of that. And there are people that are in a hard situation in ministry and really depend on that feeding on a week. I mean, you can just go down the list. It's their time that I'm responsible to the Lord for in an important way. And thinking in those terms can help think through at times. It at least gives a kind of framework for thinking through some of the harder decisions about the use of time. How the tasks may be important in their own right, how they relate to kingdom calling and to the people we serve. I have found that, particularly if you have a lot of demands in ministry, either you manage your schedule or you're schedule kind of manages you, or, you know, your all the things that there are in life kind of overwhelm you. It requires a fairly deliberate approach, a thoughtful approach. Okay, how am I going to use my time today, this week, this month? Now, I experienced that pretty acutely because I have, you know, things on my schedule, you know, at least 3 years out, some of which I already know this is the week that I'm going to have to prepare for that, and I'm probably not going to have much time before that or after that. That's the week. But in order for me to have that week for this, I need to do all these things that need to fall into their place. And so it's all, you know, it all kind of relates to one another. And I would say, it's been my experience, and, you know, this wouldn't be true in any ministry situation, but the actually seminary, that was actually the easy time. You know, even for all of the demands that I was, you know, working in the church half-time and so forth. But there's a lot of structure already given to you. You know, you've got a certain time to be in class, and you've got certain assignments that are due on a particular day. I mean, it sort of, you know, has a kind of structure and rhythm to it. But with, you know, growing family, you know, heavier burdens in ministry at church, I mean, it's much more difficult now than it was. So be cheerful about any present difficulties that you're going through, and see that as good preparation for, you know, stewardship down the road. The other thing is, typically when you're in ministry, you have a lot of control over your schedule with a lot of kind of open time. And I sat in my study for my first week in pastoral ministry, and I was sitting there one afternoon, and I said, I'm telling you right now, a lot of ministers waste a lot of time. Because, you know, nobody's looking over your shoulder. Nobody has, other than, oh, by the way, you know, basically doing the rough equivalent of a 10-page term paper every week for the rest of your life, at least one. You know, nobody's there telling you, you know, you've got to do this now or that then. And I probably pastors in a lot of situations face as much temptation for time wasting as probably almost anybody does, I would think. So that's worth thinking about, because a lot of the patterns you put into your life when you have a more structured life, those will give you tools and resources for saying, okay, here's how I need to think about my week, and here's how I need to structure things over the course of the month, and I need to be very deliberate about that. I need to bring my schedule insofar as I am able to under the lordship of Christ. The hardest decisions I face are, with regard to time, are not yes-no decisions, but yes-yes decisions. That is to say, they're not. They don't tend to be questions, choices between a good thing and a bad thing. They're choices between good things, maybe very good things, and discerning, okay, which of these very good things that people are asking me to do is my priority now? Which of these things should I really be saying no to? How do I evaluate that? I have to say, I mean, I find that to be one of the more difficult things in ministry, actually, because there are demands that come up every day and every week, and those have to be considered. I also have, you know, invitations to do things down the road, but to think about if I can do that down the road, I've got to know kind of what our family's doing at that time and how that fits in. I mean, it's, it can take me a long time just to sit down and say yes to this or no to that, and, you know, kind of how to think about that. But they're all decisions between good things. I think it's in Philippians, Paul talks about discerning what is best. I think that's very much, it's the category here. It's the kind of discernment, it's not, you know, do the righteous thing and commit the sin. It's more honor God by making the best choice out of these things that, you know, I have some gifts for doing and will be a blessing to other people. Those are the really hard issues. In working those through, I certainly talk about a lot of my scheduling issues with Lisa. You know, we'll sit down together, you know, at least once a month to kind of work out our schedule for the coming month. What nights are we home? What needs to be thought about the children? How does transportation fit in? How does babysitting fit in? I mean, it's like, you know, it's like running a multinational corporation, you know, to figure out seven schedules and how they all fit together in our house. But, you know, obviously that's very important. I do not typically accept any kind of significant commitment. I mean, by significant, I would mean like You know, even taking a night to do something, that would probably fall into that category without talking at least about the schedule, you know, thinking through what the impact is. I also meet probably like quarterly now, every 2 or 3 months, with a smaller group of our elders, and one of the things that they, there are other areas of accountability, but one of them is on schedule, and it gives me partly an easier way to say no. You know, I can say, you guys don't think I should do this, do you? No. But no, it is helpful to have some other people looking in on the schedule and also, you know, taking at least a temperature on how things are going. You know, the more demands we have in ministry, the more people who are relying on us in one way or another, the more important it is to have, you know, wise counsel about the stewardship of our time. But there's also a lot of, I mean, there's just a lot of that within our staff as well. You know, somebody will come in and say, hey, I've been asked to do this, and, you know, do you think I should do this? What, I've been thinking through, you know, what impact it'll have on the ministry. And, you know, we just kind of work through those things together. I recently was helped by something Michael Cassidy said. Michael Cassidy is one of our missionaries in South Africa. He'll be speaking at our missions conference this year. Just really great, one of the great Christian evangelical statesmen in the world, and very much in demand for all, you know, kinds of ministry. And, you know, he was saying part of his criteria is what he really wants to do, what he's really drawn to do. And making a priority of those things that are really in the sweet spot for him of ministry. Now, you have to be careful about that, because sometimes the Lord calls you to do things that you don't want to do. But there is something to that. I mean, the things that we really enjoy doing in many ways are things really at the heart of our calling. And we shouldn't be afraid to say, yeah, these are the things that I love to do, and you know, I'll make a commitment to doing it. Really, from before the time I started in pastoral ministry, one of my commitments was a personal commitment, which I think for the most part I really have kept, I would say. And that is not to commit to do something if I wasn't convinced I could do it in an excellent way. Excellent for me. Excellent for, you know, me with my gifts and limitations. So that if I was in a situation saying, yeah, I can almost stretch and just about do that, but I, you know, I'll probably be kind of going in half prepared or things like that. My commitment was I'm going to say yes with the commitment to do it in an excellent way. And if I can't really say before the Lord that I, as far as I'm able to tell, I'm able to do that, well, that's a pretty good indication. You know, that's something that I should say no to. We can talk a little bit more just about weekly schedule, but a couple of things that, you know, I found helpful just in terms of weekly schedule. Some of you will have heard me talk about preparation time for the week, but I typically try to give the better part of my mornings to sermon preparation, other preparation to teach. I'm fresher than typically, able to be more productive. It's good to have a couple of uninterrupted hours. You get into kind of a flow where you're not even conscious of what the time is, and that's when you're really, you know, typically very productive. And then in the afternoons, you know, more meeting with people for spiritual care and things that need to be done in the staff and that sort of thing. That's a good rhythm for me. I think everybody needs to find their own rhythm. Trying to begin the day with scripture at home, that's a challenge. I do better with that now probably than formerly. And have some dedicated prayer time when I come into the church as well as a kind of first thing in the day. Trying to be home most evenings for family activities between 5 o'clock and 8 o'clock. Not always, but that was a very good rhythm that we were in grad school, and that enables me to be there for kind of helping Lisa with the child who needs the most help when I come home, being helpful around dinner preparations if that's needed, there for dinner as a family and for devotions, there to help with Bible memory work, there to do some, you know, go outside and play ball, there to give baths, there to do bedtime routine. And if that's sort of the main pattern and the regular pattern, then we can adjust and freelance off of that very easily. But it's good for families to have a sort of main regular schedule, and having a good schedule actually my experience has been, helps children be more flexible for when you're off the schedule. They're able to adapt and accommodate that because they have such a sense of security and regularity. That's operating in a pretty deep way in terms of ordering their existence. I can't probably show you all that chapter and verse either, but that's sort of, practical wisdom as I see it for parenting. I certainly think it makes a huge difference for our family that we have that kind of core time that I'm directly engaged, with all the children. Let's see. I would encourage us to avoid time wasting as over against planned leisure. There's a difference between kind of not getting around to the things that you know you're supposed to get around to because you're not that motivated to do them or whatever the reasons are, you're distracted or whatever. And then kind of wasting that time. And actually what you do when you're quote-unquote wasting the time, maybe some of those things are very appropriate to do as planned leisure. Leisure time doesn't, to exercise good stewardship of leisure doesn't mean you'd like planned in all kinds of activities and you're going to, run 5 miles and then you're going to, go on to the next thing. I mean, maybe it's very open-ended time, particularly children need that, particularly young children. They need to not be sort of pushed and hustled along to everything. They need to sort of operate at their own pace, particularly for exploring things. So it's good to have some open-ended time, but there's a difference, I think, between doing that deliberately and saying, okay, this is, we're not going to try to get out of the house early this morning. We're just going to take a leisurely pace, have a leisurely breakfast, and just have a sort of open-ended time, and we're doing that, pretty deliberately. I see that as being very appropriate and a good use of time, but it tends not to be as good a use of time when there are other things that you're actually supposed to be doing, and now there's more pressure on your leisure time or has more of an impact on other people because you didn't do the things that you really were called to do when you were called to do them. I would say that over time, I've become more tightly organized. Now, I'm an organized person just by temperament. I've carried around my little day timer since I was in high school, probably freshman year, keeping track of what was going to happen when. So, I'm in a sort of, unique and maybe aberrant category there, but it certainly is a blessing. If you, in a situation like I'm in, with a lot of responsibilities for a larger congregation, it's very important to have an administrative gift that goes with that, and being organized as part of that. Not everybody has that gift. Not everybody, the Bible says not everybody has that gift. We shouldn't feel guilty if we don't have that gift, but we should recognize, okay, here are the areas where even if it's not my temperament, I must be organized for this, to do what God is calling me to do. And maybe I need to be in a ministry situation where other people with complementary gifts they have the gifts that I don't have, and they can help me be organized just to the extent that I need to be, and my gift for being less organized, will be helpful. I mean, a good example on our staff is Carol Wynn, I think. Carol is pretty well organized. He's not a disorganized person. He's not nearly as organized as I am, and he has a much higher tolerance than I do for kind of being flexible, going with the flow, dropping everything. That's a huge blessing to many people in our church on many different occasions, because I don't have the flexibility because I've got, the commitments that I've already made. And Carol can jump in and drop everything and, kind of be present for a situation that I'm not able to be, or that kind of thing. So I think we should recognize here an aspect of spiritual gifting and temperament that's very appropriate, and you work out how to apply these principles as you go. There are another number of, little things that I do now. If you look around this office, you see there are a lot of piles of papers for different things. Well, everything, is in the place it needs to be. On my desk, I now have some separation between a pile of that relates to meetings and things coming up this week, and it's in order. The stuff for today is on top, and when that's taken off, there'll be the stuff for tomorrow. Then I have a pile for, correspondence or people that I need to check in with. It's like letters that I need to write or emails I need to send, or maybe people that I need to call. And that pile is probably loosely in priority order, and there's a colored piece of paper halfway down the stack, and the things that don't have to be done this week are underneath that paper, and the things that really do need to be done this week are on top of that. And then the things that really need to be done and probably need to be done next of all the things are over here in a pile by themselves. And then I have, you know, there are other piles for different things. I also find it very helpful in just dealing with sort of the flow of regular paperwork and correspondence to put little notes at the top of things so that when I look through a paper once, I can indicate when I need to look at it again or what needs to be done with it. So I'm not always flipping through papers, say, oh yeah, there's that again. No, it's right there what needs to happen and what its place is. You know, those are the things that I find, you know, helpful on a practical basis in sort of keeping track of things. Those are some of the main things. What do you guys want to talk more about?
How do you get the piles organized? Because I have piles, but I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, so probably they need to be subdivided, but maybe it's the little note at the top that says, you know, file this away, or and you have to also be willing to throw stuff away as soon as you don't need it anymore and not have so much of a, yeah, maybe I'll need this later. Make a decision about it. Mm-hmm. What needs to be done with this and when? And, you know, be pretty, you know, deliberate and specific about that. Most people that sort of, I've never read anything on time management or five-minute manager or those kinds of things. But I think most people will tell you, if you look at those kinds of things, it's pretty important to deal with it one time if you can, or if you can't deal with it then, like, slot it into its place so you'll know when it will be dealt with. It's a helpful skill.
One question I have is about email. And, you know, it can be an incredible time waster. And I'm wondering how you sort of structure that to be effective.
Yeah. What I used to do was better than what I do now. So this will be like the Pharisees. Do as I tell you, not as I do. I used to not look at email until I was done with my preparation time in the morning. I found that a little harder with just the volume of email I deal with now. I'm not at a point now where I'm not having email and only having somebody else look at it for me, or at a place where I'm saying I will not respond to unsolicited email. Although I think that could be an appropriate response to have in a particular situation. I mean, I try to respond to, you know, any question I get asked, or certainly anything from any member of this congregation. But even beyond that, you know, somebody has a theological question or, you know. I typically respond to most email the day that it arrives. I like to not let a big, you know, backlog build up. I try to be content with shorter responses to things. This is a different topic, but I don't respond to anything upsetting until I'm less upset about it, you know, maybe the next day. That's a pretty important thing with email generally. So now I do typically check it a couple times in the morning, and it can be kind of a distraction. You've got sort of a free moment, and I'll just check email, see what's coming in. You know, it's not just it's part of the danger there is the interruption, because for some kinds of work you really need to get into the flow and not be interrupted in it to really get to that deeper level of productivity. And you know, you're interrupted a lot. I also have a huge advantage, I would say, in having, you know, an assistant who can sort of handle, you know, some of the traffic during the day and sort of say, oh yeah, okay, that's really important, you'd want to be bothered for that. Mm-hmm. You know, anything Lisa wants to talk to me about, that's on the list, or, you know, pretty much anything any other staff person is, because they wouldn't interrupt unless they, you know, really needed to. You know, you don't always have that luxury, but I think it's, you know, good to get away for a morning, not at the church if you're in a kind of solo pastorate, and that's really going to be much more productive. Or, you know, not to feel you, and this is an important principle, you answer to the Lord for your time primarily. You don't answer to every person that has a different opinion about what you ought to be doing for them. And oftentimes, the people that will give you a little more of a guilt trip, it's actually telling you more about them and their spiritual needs than about you and your calling. So, we had a good example today. An email came in with a ministry need, and somebody on staff said, hey, I need some input on this. Here's the email, and here's what the demand is. I feel like I need some counsel. Let's talk about this tomorrow. Well, that's, you know, there's a lot of wisdom to that. It's easy, the person that's sort of demanding your time, there's a lot of immediacy to that, and that calls for, you know, discernment at times. Now, there's a flip side to that, which is being so protective of my schedule, my agenda, that I can easily justify, you know, pushing a lot of people and a lot of things off because, you know, I don't really want to be bothered with it, and I now have kind of a justification because I have this approach to the stewardship of my time. So you can, you know, you can certainly err and probably sin in both directions of that. So it, you know, falls for a lot of wisdom and discernment.
Just a quick,
yeah,
kind of quick follow-up. I mean, do you tend to group emails and phone calls as opposed to, say, to go back and forth? I mean, would that be an ideal?
I think probably, I think that would probably depend on individual temperament. And you just get to see, am I being less efficient? I mean, sometimes there's a point of sort of breaking things up. I personally, if I'm going to do email, I'm going to do all the email and work all the way through it and be done with that. And I'm more of a person, and actually this is, you know, another thing. Sometimes, there are tasks that are kind of easier to get done. So it's very attractive to sort of, okay, these are the things that I can take advantage and control. At least I can get these things done. But actually, there's a phone call that's going to be a difficult conversation that's actually a much more important priority here. And I sort of have the impression of being efficient here, but it's actually not good stewardship because here's this other thing that really more needs to be done. So I would say that's a temptation to watch out for. And I tend to be a kind of, that's certainly a temptation for me because I tend to be kind of a triage person. If I come back from vacation, I've got a lot of mail on my desk. It's hard for me to just push everything aside and say, okay, sermon preparation, this is going to be the first thing. I'm more kind of person to say, okay, let's get all of this out of my mind. Now I can actually focus on it. And probably there are times when it's appropriate to do that as you look at your total stewardship. But beware of the temptation to sort of do the easier things, putting off the harder thing if it's the more important thing.
I have a question about writing. I guess this would be theft. It's the balance between theft and people-oriented things. How do you schedule in time? I mean, research and writing takes a lot of time. If you want to write books, you know, not everybody does. How do you schedule that in with preaching, teaching, family, emails, letter writing, spending time with people? I mean,
Right. Yeah, I'll answer that question. Let me preface it though by saying this, that I think the important thing to get from me is mainly principles that seem universal and biblical, and then figure out how to work them out in your own situation. And, I'm not necessarily normal in all aspects, nor should I be emulated in all aspects. And particularly when writing, when it comes to writing, you know, I'm productive in a way that most people will not be, just to be, you know, frank about that. There are reasons for that. One is, I read very rapidly, assimilate very rapidly, and so there's that aspect too. Also, I have a very privileged situation in that I'm in a church that recognizes that as part of my calling that is in various ways beneficial to the church, but also beneficial to the wider church and therefore part of our calling as a congregation. That, you know, that predates my time, but that's part of our sort of understanding and calling as a congregation, which means that, you know, from the day I got here, you know, it was well understood. Yes, you have generous amounts of time, really, to work on preaching and, you know, developing those. Now, most of the writing I do comes out of the other teaching that I'm doing. So typically what I will do is I typically preach from a full manuscript, which is, and actually the main manuscript is actually longer than what I preach. I sort of reduce things, say more about some things and less about other things. But typically by the end of the week, I've got pretty much a chapter of an expository commentary, you know, in pretty good shape. I'll go back the following week and spend maybe up to an hour revising it, improving it, you know, things that didn't come off so well on Sunday that, you know, needed more need to be said about this or less about that, or that wasn't that clear, it could have been clearer, you know, those kind of things. And then I will, and I'll typically do that revision kind of at the end of the morning of sermon preparation. I'll kind of get to a good stopping place. Here's one little tip, by the way. We can talk about sermon preparation another time, but I think it might have been James Michener said this about writing. It's kind of good to stop when you still have a little bit of sense of the next thing that you would say, rather than sort of getting to the point where you just say, okay, I don't know where to go next. Well, for some people that can be very effective. You come back the next day and maybe you do know where to go next in your sermon outline or whatever it is. But there is a point to saying, to coming back the next day and you're like, oh yeah, okay, yeah, and, you know, here's where I was going to go, and you're kind of more quickly into the flow of things. So that may be useful for some. Most of the editing work I do for writing is work that I'll do in the evenings. I've got a huge challenge right now because I've got 112 chapters on Luke. I mean, it's thousands of pages. It all has to be carefully edited. I've had three people read through it and give me their critique and comments and things that need to be incorporated and changed and fixed and so forth. So, you know, I'm trying to do five of those chapters every week. You know, some nights I can do a couple chapters, some nights I can do a chapter, you know, that sort of thing. It's much easier with longer writing projects to do it kind of little by little than in one big thing. Now, I also typically use some study week and sabbatical time. I get 2 study weeks a year. I'll typically maybe revise a shorter book in a week or write a chapter for something from scratch or, you know, that kind of thing. And a couple of the writing projects I've done have taken some sabbatical time. A couple of the projects I did with my dad, you know, were like, I had 5 or 6 weeks to get to a project to really get, you know, a bigger chunk of work done. One thing, and actually Jim Boyce gave me this advice about revising things week by week while you still remember how they need to be revised, rather than sort of coming back to a manuscript from scratch. I mean, get it to a pretty good place, you know, that week. So now when I go back to my Luke material, I actually thought there would be less to improve than there is. I mean, there's a fair amount. I mean, you know, there's hardly any page in any of those manuscripts that hasn't needed some correction or improvement of some kind. But it's, you know, it's pretty far along. It's, you know, it's pretty close. So it's not an onerous burden to do that editing further on. So what else? What else do you want to kick around? Johnny's got a question over there.
Okay, so I guess the whole life being the sermon, like my struggle would definitely be people over time, every single time. And although I am a pretty jealous about time set aside for the sermon.
Mm-hmm. And time for Laura?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I guess like what I'm working on right now is people know how to get a yes out of things. Like, they'll say certain words that'll, like, go off in my head, and I'll totally not be able to resist, like, I'll just say it. I guess that's kind of related to what you're saying, like, that quote about that guy, like, do what you know, feel, like, most passionate about or driven towards. And I guess, like, a lot of the times I find it hard to discern, like, what is of most value to the kingdom, you know? And so to me, like, I'll gladly put something aside for somebody that, you know, on the verge of becoming a Christian and what can be done on that coffee. Like, that's just obvious to me. So, like, where do you draw the line?
Yeah, for a couple of things. You know, I think it's good for us to have sort of aspect of struggle with this, so that it becomes a matter for prayer that we need to keep working through. It's not going to be a sort of cut and dry thing. It is going to be, you know, to some extent situational. I think actually, I don't think the first question I would ask is what's going to be of more value to the kingdom. I think that's a pretty hard question to answer. Now, if somebody, I mean, if somebody is, you know, wanting to talk to you about, you know, the claims of Christ, I mean, that's, you know, whoosh, that's like way up at the top of the priority list. I mean, you can find a way to get done some of the other things you need to get done. I mean, so, but it's actually, there are lots of other things. It's pretty hard to assess the value to the kingdom. I mean, like for you, for example, I mean, you know, some kid in Camden that you've got a relationship with is asking for help with this area of discipleship. Is that more valuable to the kingdom than the message you're preparing for TIFF, than the study and preparation you're doing for a lifetime of ministry? I mean, how do you do the calculation on that? I mean, that becomes pretty difficult. I think, and for me then, a better question to me is, what are the things that I am called to do? Okay, I know I'm called to love my wife because I've made a promise before God to do that. I know that I'm called to be a student for this season of life. I know that I am called to do this, you know, sort of area of ministry for the church, you know, because this is the commitment I have to TIFF or whatever. Now, I have other relationships, and I have callings in those other relationships, but I should be thinking of it in terms of not what's going to make the biggest impact, but what is my true calling. And now sometimes we get ourselves in a situation where we've said yes to things we perhaps weren't supposed to say yes to. So now we sort of do have a commitment or a promise. We sort of obligated ourselves to something. That means, you know, and I particularly with my children, it is rare for me to promise something. It's rarer than that for me to promise something I don't deliver on, because I'm careful about, you know, what I promise. I also, in wrestling through those questions, I would also say, you know, it's been my experience lots and lots and lots of times, I have a sense of burden and weight that someone has asked me to do something. And I've had lots of experiences of having to say, no, actually. And then seeing how the Lord provides what that person does in some other person who hasn't gone up. And I had a good example of this week. Somebody's in a very difficult family situation that has a legal dimension to it. And asked me basically to go to Manhattan for what would take a whole day to be with them for a legal proceeding that would probably take place, but it could also be one of those things where it would sort of get canceled and whatever. So there's a part of me that wants to say, yeah, I'm your pastor, I'm there for you. There's another part of me that's saying, wow, if I do that, that has an implication on all of these other things. You know, where is the wisdom or the balance or the discernment in it? So I called a couple of colleagues to come in and said, here's the situation, here's the sort of dilemma I'm feeling. We talked about it. Somebody else had a relationship, and they were going to follow up personally to sort of find out more about the situation, and they would have a little more freedom to sort of assess it without the sort of kind of a request hanging over them and so on. What ended up happening was that staff member had the longer conversation to be spiritually supported, longer than the conversation I had had, although that conversation had a certain value. I was the person to sit down and pray with them on Sunday, sit down and have some good time just praying about these concerns. Then actually it turned out to be a family member that could go to New York to do the trip. And here at the beginning, I'm feeling the weight of this claim that somebody has, but actually, that wasn't the calling that the Lord had for me, and there was a much better plan that worked out. But if I'm always saying yes all the time, then there are other people who are not getting the chance to exercise the gift of data, and very importantly in ministry, there are lots of times when people are sort of reaching out and wanting you to do something for them, but actually they can learn from saying, okay, yeah, I can see that this isn't what you're supposed to do, or maybe you're turning me down and I'm upset with you, and now we've got to kind of think in our relationship we've got to work out because you've said no to me. But actually, that's driving them to trust in the Lord in a different way. And I've had lots of experiences of people coming back to me and saying, you know, I don't know if you could tell, but I was a little offended when you said, no, you couldn't.
Yeah.
But here's how the Lord really met me in my situation, and I haven't. And so let's have that in mind, that we're not the only person that can be the need meter, you know, in the body of Christ, and that's a pretty important thing too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for me, trust that you, like, I have a tendency to take things to, like, the worst possible scenario, and, like, well, so you've gone and burnt the relationship right there, and, like, that, you know, somebody else with a really bad view of the church, and pastors, you can't even use, like, a simple, perhaps it's not simple, but you know what I mean? And so that's, like, a trust issue for me, where, like, I mean, to believe, well, you know, God is sovereign, and this person's faith or involvement in the church isn't going to hang upon you, or individual.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, extending ourselves to others is an important part of our witness. But if somebody is sort of taking the attitude, you've got to measure up to this, I mean, that's an impossible burden in itself. There's a deeper spiritual issue there. And, you know, I can think of, I'm just checking my watch to keep us on track tonight, but, you know, I've also had, in fact, I had a situation last week. Somebody said to me, somebody said, can you do this? And he was sort of viewing it from his perspective and his situation and what he's asking me to do. I mean, that is the most important thing, and it should be for him in all kinds of ways as appropriate. But I said, no, you know, I have a commitment, you know, to my children. Actually, I'll tell you what it was. It was, you know, planning to take this Friday off to take my younger children to the zoo. And his comment was, and it wasn't, he didn't mean it in a sort of mean-spirited way, but there was a little edge to it, was, well, I can see where I rank. Well, yeah. That is where you rank in my sense of my calling. I actually had, I've had another one of our former interns came back to me at a certain point, and he had asked me to do something, and I had said, he describes it as being more abrupt than I would hope that it was, but I basically, he said, can you meet me at this time for that? And I said, no, I'll be walking home to have dinner with my family. And he came back and said, you know, that really helped me because that's an area where I struggle and I need to be clear about what my calling is. So, you know, it can be done in a gracious way. But that's why I emphasize, you know, we answer to the Lord primarily for our time, and it's the human relationships are secondary to that. And the other thing I would say, Johnny, is that temperament and that impulse probably has an influence on where you will operate best in terms of your long-term calling. To me, it's a great schedule to have half days that are where there's a lot of solitude and then half a day where there's more interaction. That's a good balance for me. When we have a day like Sunday where, you know, I spend a lot of time sort of interacting with people, it's very tiring for me. By nature, I'm not a sort of extroverted person. I'm more on the introverted side of things. But other people have a different sort of temperament, and you probably want a ministry situation that has, just of its very nature, there's a lot of relational, helping people with practical needs, you know, that kind of thing. Good. What other things do we want to kick around, get into, ask about? A challenge. Question.
Question about the schedule. So, it's the beginning of a week. Is that when you tend to sit down and say, here's when I'm going to do what? And if that's how you do it, what does that look like? Or how do you sort of nuts and bolts?
Yeah.
That's
much too late to be thinking about the week. I mean, it's... You know, I have my day timer, so I've got, you know, the main sort of things in the schedule, the meetings, the teaching commitments, the different things. I also have in there week by week, a weekly to-do list, right? These are the things I need to get done this week. And if you look through my schedule book for the next months on end, you will see some things slotted in each of those weeks. You know, this has to be done this week, that has to be done. And I've got little notes to myself like, you must begin preparing for Indianapolis this week, or, you know, some things like that that are in there. And then I, you know, reevaluate it when I get to the time. Lisa and I are typically looking at the schedule for the coming month before the month starts, the week before the week starts in a briefer conversation. And you know, I need to be giving some thought to that, you know, before the week arrives. And I'll have little notes to myself on my to-do list, you know, a little note Tuesday or, you know, things like that. Now, do all of those things get done on time? No, they do not. I'm embracing my finitude now, and I am saying, okay, I thought these were things that needed to get done this week, but okay, here are the things that really must get done this week, and then here are the things that can, you know, wait until next week, and, you know, things need to be reevaluated. So it's a, you know, it's a changing situation, but the more that's in there to begin with, the better, you know, from my perspective. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm also the kind of person that when I was in school, mapped out all of my readings for the whole semester, you know, so many pages per day or so many pages per week, you know, figuring out how the whole thing fit together. I mean, that's my temperament. Not everybody has to do it that way. But the principle there is that time management does take some, you know, planning ahead.
It sounds like that's something that comes pretty naturally and easily.
Interesting. I had an interesting observation about this. I shared this with Lisa. I may do a blog on it at some point. It's slightly off the point. But one of the reasons why I'm convinced that my sort of skills for organization were significantly honed by my interest in sports. Collecting and organizing baseball cards, playing a lot of sports strategy games, you know, knowing all the teams and all the rosters, and yeah, Stratomatic, there you go. I think that sort of sharpened a lot of those organizations, sort of made really good use of that. And I was reflecting on a reason I'd never thought about it before. I think just an amazing gift from the Lord that he would give me those things to do that would prepare me for things that I would do later on in an area of life that I just really enjoy. And I just see a lot of the Lord's, you know, grace in that and saying, now, okay, here's little Philip. I know what he's going to do. These are some of the things that he's going to do with his life. Now, okay, here are the skills that he's going to need, and now this would be just a really enjoyable way to hone those skills. I mean, that's my sort of sense as I reflected on it. And I think we should each be able to see some of the things are not so pleasurable, some of them are more difficult and painful experiences we've gone through, and I have those as well. But it's part of the preparation that God, you know, gives to us to put us in that unique, you know, situation where we're really able to connect, you know, in just the way that we should for the calling that we have. So, yeah, Nick?
You mentioned you might write a blog on that. What are your thoughts on blogging, the internet? Because that can be a huge time damage.
Yep, absolutely. And, you know, I'm probably nearly, I mean, I think with the internet, and, you know, I did a window on the world on this a long time ago, more than a decade ago, on just what a powerful purveyor of pornography the internet was going to be, and just what a huge issue that was going to be. I'm nearly as concerned, I think, about just issues of stewardship of time, because, I mean, it's just anything you're interested in, it's all out there, all kinds of, you know, information, and this can be looked at, and YouTube, and things that are funny, and things that are artistic, and things that are, you know, have to do with sports, and I mean, it's just, So it's an area to be very, very careful about. I probably think that some people need very strict structure for that because they really are not at a place where they can be sort of trusted with themselves for their use of time. And so, you know, whatever it takes to, you know, get to that situation, whatever, you know, framework or structure you need for that, I think, you know, can be important. I know an elder of this church that asks, you know, the hotel to remove the television before he, you know, goes into his room, partly because he doesn't want to have a temptation to pornography. That's part of it, but it's also time wasting, you know, job where you're on the road a lot. You know, there are practical things that you can do to, you know, in that area. I'm pretty down on a lot of blog conversation because a lot of it doesn't have an editor. So unless you choose wisely, you're not necessarily getting things that are truly excellent. You want a sort of winnowing process. Now, I think there are blog sites that are worth visiting. I don't particularly a lot of the theological conversation that goes back and forth, particularly seminary students or pastors, hopefully both of us in that, I don't find always that edifying or deep or rich. So I think it's important to be more, you know, selective about what you... Do you want me to be more specific than that? Or?
I guess there is a lot of good stuff online, and, you know, I guess I've found it to be somewhat important for me to know what's out there in the evangelical world beyond, you know, just the reform world. And there's a lot to learn. You know, I've in some ways tried to justify my time on the internet by saying, well, I am reading. You know, it's not reading a book. But I am.
Sure.
I have learned a lot. Now, how do I then take that and narrow it down and say, okay, this is essential. I appreciate what you said, stay away from conversations, because that's, you know, back and forth conversations is a trap. It seems like a lot of ways. It's fruitless. So, what advice would you have about, you know, narrowing it down to how we use it?
Yeah.
I know that's kind of a...
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would say, I would probably use similar criteria to the kinds of things I think about when I think about other reading. Okay, so what's the reading I want to do on a sort of weekly basis? Well, I like to read books and culture, you know, by Christianity Today, kind of Christianity and culture. I like to read the New York Review of Books, which is also a lot of cultural issues, some political issues from a secular, liberal perspective, but well-written. You know, there's a lot to interact with and engage with. I like to read Sports Illustrated. That's sort of planned leisure. I like to read Time Magazine. I used to like to read Time Magazine. They've just done a kind of overhaul of how they do Time Magazine. I'm not going to subscribe to it anymore. It's a different conversation. But I also like to read the newspaper, particularly what's happening in Philadelphia. You know, there are certain categories that I want to be exposed to, and there are other things that you could slot in for one of those and get some of the same kind of input. Kind of for trends in evangelicalism generally, you know, I'd probably get a little more of that from Christianity Today than I would get online. I think there's value in knowing what people are thinking and talking about, but it shouldn't be overestimated. I mean, I think C.S. Lewis had a point in saying, you really want to know what's going on, you need to understand the human heart, and you can get all of those issues from the old books that have really been well written. You don't need to sort of be up to date, quote unquote, on everything. I think probably one of the reasons John Piper is more profound than, you know, 99% of other pastors that we read is because he makes a point of not watching television. I mean, you know, if a bridge class is in Minneapolis, he understands what's happening, you know, but it's not from sort of knowing all the latest things about urban tribes and different things. I also, you know, have people give me a lot of things to read, so I'm in kind of a privileged position that way because people usually say, oh, yeah, this, you really ought to read this, and, you know, I get a lot of good input that way. So, but, you know, those are the kinds of things. I want a range of secular and Christian, reformed and evangelical you know, sort of breadth to it.
Mm-hmm.
Wondering about two things. One, if you could talk more about sort of how you think about your time with your family, and particularly, I mean, obviously you can't say you spend X number of hours, you know, here and X number of hours there, and you said you're sort of home from 5 to 8, but just thinking through, especially with evenings, you know, clearly doing college ministry and campus things, you know, evenings are when I spend a lot of my time now. And of course, I have a, you know, 8-to-4 job. So, you know, how to think through those things, that's sort of one part. And the other part is, I just thinking about, like, this phrase, planned leisure, is kind of funny, because, like, I don't have 5 minutes of planned leisure, like, in a month, you know? It's just like, how do I, like, you know, and maybe I should, maybe that's the problem, but...
Well, then, and, I mean, then you start with, you work incrementally. You say, okay, I need to take an hour with my wife this week doing the leisure things that she likes to do that I can engage in. You know, that's what you sort of, so, you know, for Lisa and for me, you know, Sunday evening after church, that's like, you know, that's, we really safeguard that. We won't take calls from her mother, you know, on Sunday evening because, you know, we have, you know, that's our time together to play Scrabble or do different things that we like to do. So, you know, maybe there can be a sort of, you know, deliberate, and certain kinds of leisure can be done in very, you know, brief periods of time. I mean, you can sort of get to a place of shalom, you know, in 5 minutes with a kid on your lap, you know.
For me, I guess. But.
Well, yeah, I mean, another, just a practical thing on that, I mean, one thing I found helpful, particularly with the boys, is if there's been more active kind of roughhousing time, I will go through a sort of calm-down routine where we do things like, I mean, when they're little, not Josh, obviously, now, but where we sort of, okay, we're going to count up to 10, and we're going to take a deep breath between each one of these, and you know, just talk to him about enjoying just resting here or lying in her back and winking at the stars or whatever it is. So, I mean, I think there are some things that may be helpful there, but that's a different topic. I mean, you're in a, you know, probably not in a situation that's very sustainable for ministry. If you're doing, really throwing yourself into college ministry, you probably need a family schedule that maximizes some of your other flexibility. Like, you know, you have morning time together, or you're home at lunch every day with your family, or you're home lunch 3 days a week, but, you know, then you're out for some dinner, so that you're sort of flexing the schedule. When my father-in-law was in medical school at Penn, he was on one rotation that was just a killer rotation. I mean, he was sleeping at the hospital, I mean, but he had, like, I don't know, half an hour for lunch that he could count on or whatever, and Lisa's mom would get the rest of the family together, take a picnic, and facilitate everything around, you know, his engagement during those times. So you have to, you know, sort of take, you know, the time that you have. I do think it's hugely important over the long run that ministry not be done at the expense of our families. I mean, that's just, you know, for as long as I've known Lisa, in our first conversations about even what our relationship meant and ministry meant, I mean, that was, you know, foundational for us. And so, you know, not letting go of that priority and making sure that you're talking with Deborah about that. Do you feel like we're at a place where I'm making sacrifices that are inappropriate for what you need and what the children need? Now, there are also things she can do so that you're really taking maximum advantage of the time, you know, that you do have together, you know, and you know, you have to figure out what that means in each situation. I mean, for me, one of the things it means is when I come home, one of the first things that I need to do is find out what Lisa thinks I need to be doing in relationship either to her or usually to the kids. You know, who needs attention, who needs help, who needs to go outside, who needs the conversation about something that happened during the day, you know, so that it's really, you know, engaging. So that's, That's important. Is that getting anywhere close to your question, or what can I comment on more? The other thing is, when children get older, there are more ways that they can sort of overlap with kind of things that we're doing in ministry, you know, kinds of ministry contexts they can go into and participate in a different way than they can when they're younger. Now, having said that, the important thing is not that they find a way to integrate with your life and your world, but that you find a way to integrate with their life and their world. You know, eventually they kind of figure out who you are and what you're about and what you do, but the relational building things are you figuring out who they are and what they like to do, and, you know, that's the, you know, direction of things. You want to come back on any of that, or say, what about this?
I'll listen to the MP3 and think about it for a while.
I'm going to follow up to that, it may be helpful. In delegating to others, there's got to be a good deal of training. I mean, you can't just push things off on people and expect them. And I know this may be a question dealing with the whole workings of the church, essentially, in training and discipleship. In your position, which we may never be in the same sort of position, what would maximum training of, you know, a small group around you look like for training others or enabling others to be equipped? I know the pulpit ministry is huge in that, but enabling others to be equipped where you can then, you know, cast things off to others.
I think probably in any situation, delegation is going to be important. I mean, even in just kind of running a household and figuring out some of the chores that, you know, children need to be doing, there's an aspect of figuring out who has the gifts to handle what task at what time, and, you know, I think there's, and if you've got sort of volunteers in ministry, or you're going on a mission trip in the summer, or, you know, I mean, Brian, I'm sure, had a lot of delegation issues on SMI this summer. You know, what are some of the principles we go with that? I'm not sure that's particularly an area where I excel necessarily. So you may be able to get better advice from others. I think a couple things are important. One is not so much telling people what to do, but engaging with them in a conversation where they have the freedom to say, I don't have time to do that, or I'm not sure how to get that done, so that there's some give and take in the delegation process. So that's an important aspect. Number two is there's certain kinds of delegation you've got to sort of pay your dues a little bit to take the time to help somebody understand what the task is so that they can do it well. And in the long run, that's a good investment of time. And in the short term, you sometimes feel like you hardly have time to do it because you need somebody to already be thinking the way that you think about how to handle a responsibility. There's no way to do that very quickly. You have to kind of walk through something with somebody. And so it does take some time, but it's a good investment in terms of what they are able to do and what you are able to do. I think that it's pretty important, I would say, particularly in a multi-staff church situation, for other people that you sometimes have to ask to help you, or who are in a situation where if you ask them, they kind of have to help you. I mean, you know, Marion Clark is virtually in that situation. Not that he could never turn me down, but it's his job to facilitate, in many ways, you know, other things that I'm doing in ministry in a way that helps the congregation. It's easier to do that cheerfully if that person also knows that you're there 100% for the things that they need, so that when they have the week where they have the difficult sermon preparation, you're encouraging them, praying for them, you know, asking how things are going, or if you know they're in a particularly difficult time and you go back to them and say, hey, can I, you know, take this off your shoulders right now? I mean, if there's some of that real sense of commitment that you're there for them for anything, 100%, then I think it makes it a more joyful task for them to be there you know, 100% for you. I think there's a sort of give and take with that. I think delegation typically multiplies ministry if things are well delegated to people that have a calling and gift to do that. And if you only exercise a ministry that you for which you have direct oversight, what you are able to do for the kingdom of God will be constrained. It'll be a more limited ministry. I'm not saying that there aren't ministries that call for that, but what multiplies ministry is people that say, okay, I've been trained, I have the training, and I understand my calling to do this, and I understand you're supporting me in doing this and giving me the freedom to go do it, and to come back to you with, you know, problems that come up or help that I need and so forth. I mean, that's when, you know, the work of gospel ministry just gets, you know, multiplied. So, you know, I'm very pro delegation, if you want to call it that. I mean, cooperative ministry where people are using the gifts that they have and getting the encouragement and leadership they need to be able to do that. I think overall here at Tent, I think you'll see some good models of that, you know, just in the different areas of ministry that different people have. I mean, Carol's a good example. I think, you know, he has a leadership team that he's not always sort of looking over their shoulder and telling them it's got to be this way. You know, they have freedom to be creative with events and different things. And, okay, what else? We've got a few more minutes before we close in prayer. I think people really wanted to get into that we didn't get into.
Do you have a Sabbath?
Yeah, you know, I have a sort of half of a Sabbath. It's the biggest thing I don't like about pastoral ministry is not worshiping every week with my family. That's probably the biggest thing I don't, the biggest thing. Pretty close under there is not having the same kind of, you know, sort of rhythm for Sabbath experience that, you know, I grew up with. I'm usually not at home for the sort of getting ready for church time. I mean, that's a pretty heavy burden that Lisa bears. Probably at least half of the time we have, you know, Sunday afternoon pretty free, and that's going to be, you know, resting and recreational, in various ways. And then Sunday evening, you know, after evening worship, you know, typically is, you know, really resting time. I try to take off half a day in the week, usually in an afternoon, and as much of Saturday as circumstances allow. It's not the same kind of rhythm. It's a little more flexible than that, and I see some, you know, weaknesses with that. I also think that to the extent that I am able to trust the Lord for the things that I haven't figured out in how to preach a passage, or the fact that I'm very far behind in being where I need to be because of things that needed to be done, or trusting the Lord for, you know, a difficult pastoral situation I'm not sure what to do with. I mean, the more that I'm really able to trust the Lord for all of those things, the more rest I'm able to find in sort of the in-between times, rather than being sort of a place of really being maxed out and stressed out. And so there is a kind of resting in the Lord in a very fundamental way for everything that makes a big difference in the amount of stress I feel about things, and therefore maybe an even bigger difference in the amount of stress that other people that are close to me feel. You know, just the way that stress plays itself out in, you know, a marriage or family life as well. You know, that's a pretty big sort of daily, you know, I think, gospel-centered issue. So you guys have it all? Got it all sorted out?
Much to be pleased.
You know, Lisa actually shared with something really interesting with me about the difference between men and women. Women who do not get 7 hours of sleep at least have a much higher incidence of high blood pressure and then all the attendant difficulties that go with that. For men, it's a lower figure, maybe up to 2 hours lower. That was pretty interesting because that's sort of our experience. I need less sleep than Lisa does. You know, I can get along pretty well getting 6 hours a night most of the time. I probably need some catch-up time during the week. I probably actually function better, though, with more like at least 7. And I know there's a pretty big difference between kind of the summer. Summer's a little slower paced. We're not, you know, part of our challenge is, as some of you know, all 7 of us have to be out of the house by 7:30, so that means all the lunches, all the homework, all the coats, all the, you know, all the everything. You know, having had, hopefully, breakfast, godly interactions generally, you know, hopefully some family devotion time. I mean, you know, it's not a small challenge to do all those things. And in the summer, you know, there's just a lot more flexibility. We don't have to be out, you know, quite at that time. And I feel more sort of probably refreshed and resilient at that point. Am I sinning against the Lord by not getting more rest than I do? Maybe. I don't know. That's a, you know, it's a sort of hard issue to work through, you know, sort of on a day in, you know, day out basis. But I can function pretty well for, you know, weeks on end, you know, kind of 6 hours a night. And we typically go to bed around 11, and I will often read for at least another hour after that, you know, kind of wind down time, and then we're up at, you know, up at 6. And Lisa often, she'll often have a nap in the afternoon for a while to touch up on, you know, some of the things she needs, you know, depending on schedule. So.